Thank you. Thank you for being here. We'll just let everyone get our seats. First, I want to say I'm John Peaty. I'll be the moderator. I'm the publisher of the Virginia Quarterly Review here at UVA. And I have the privilege of going to a lot of book festivals across the country. And I must say, from the participants we have, from the audiences, just from the organizational leadership, this is absolutely one of the nation's great ones. So why don't we just thank Jane and the whole staff for the book festival, for everything they do, and our volunteers. And a few housekeeping notes. First, let's turn off our cell phones or anything else that that might ring. If you want to mute it and tweet, that is encouraged. The hashtag is VA Book 2016. A couple of ways that, concrete ways you can support the festival. One is filling out the evaluation. When the city and other donors have to think about whether this is effective, what you say really matters, and it helps them make decisions about programming. Second, I think at the end of this panel, from hearing these three great authors, I think you're going to be like me. You're going to desire their books, and they're for sale in the back. We have a table set up for their signing. Once we finish, we'll try to move the authors to the back and not have too much conversation on stage so we can clear it for the next panel. So I think that is it. And I mentioned their books, but just for the ocular proof, to quote Othello, we'll start here. We'll go to Michael and then to Matt. And as I look at the names, it occurs to me if we placed you with a Luke, we would have the four Gospels up here. So, but we're going to keep you anyway, Mike. Okay. Yeah, so I'll introduce the three speakers together, and then each one will read a section. And we're going to have some conversation among ourselves. We're going to bring you into it. So please have questions ready. Let me begin with our first speaker. Mark Edmondson is the author of Self and Soul. That's the book he'll be talking about here, A Defense of Ideals. He is University Professor of English here at UVA. He has written on a number of topics, and I think the flexibility of between his scholarship and his popular culture writing is really remarkable. Recent books include Why Football Matters, My Education in the Game, which came out in 2014. In 2013, Why Teach? And then also The Fine Wisdom and Perfect Teachings of the Kings of Rock and Roll. I don't know if we're going to get to rock and roll, but I do know it's the best title of the lot. we're just delighted to have you with us. And Michael Pearson is the author of Reading Life, on books, memory, and travel. He teaches creative writing at Old Dominion University. And Willie Morris, the just remarkable late editor of Harper's, said, Michael Pearson is one of our nation's finest memoirists. And coming from Willie Morris, who was one of the finest of a half century, I think that says a great deal about your gift, and we're so glad to have you here as well. And last, we'll hear from Matt Barisi. And Matt is the author of Dead White Guys, A Father, His Daughter, and the Great Books of the Western World, and also a novel, which he has another panel on, Nonprofit. He's been the executive director of a number of central cultural organizations, the Association of Writers and Writing Programs, Penn Faulkner, and he has, in the last year, moved to Rhode Island, where he is overseeing the Providence Athenaeum. So we're delighted to have all three of you. And we will open up with Mark just giving us a taste for the book.
Okay. Is this getting to you okay? Great. My book is called Self and Soul, A Defense of Ideals. It was published this fall by Harvard University Press. Basically, it tells the story of four of the West's major ideals: compassion, courage, and the quest for wisdom. And also, in the last part of the book, it tells the story of imagination as an ideal, as a realizable but high ideal. It also includes chapters about two figures whom I think of as anti-idealists. One of those figures is Sigmund Freud. The other is, perhaps rather surprisingly to some of you, William Shakespeare. Right? I call the state that a person arrives at when he or she is pursuing an ideal, trying to be compassionate, trying to think hard and pursue the truth, I call those states soul states, the states that are exist extant when a person is seeking his or her own individual desires. I call the state of self. I'll read you just a very short section from the beginning, and then if you wish to talk about it now or later, we can do that. This is a book about ideals and about their potential disappearance from the world. It is no secret. Culture in the West has become progressively more practical, materially oriented, and skeptical. When I look out at my students about to graduate, I see people who are in the process of choosing a way to make money, a way to succeed, a strategy for getting on in life. Or they are, in a few instances, rejecting the materially based life, though often with no cogent alternative to pursue in its stead. It's no news. We're more and more a worldly culture, a money-based culture geared to the life of getting and spending, trying and succeeding, and reaching for more and more. We are pragmatic people. We do not seek perfection in thought or art, war or faith. The profound stories about heroes and saints are passing from our minds. We are, in general, anything but idealists. From the halls of academia, debunking realism is the order of the day, to the floor of the market, where debunking realism is also the order of the day, nothing is in worse repute than the ideal. Unfettered capitalism runs amok. Nature is ravaged, the rich gorge. Prisons are full to bursting. The poor cry out in their misery, and no one seems to hear. Lust of self rules the day. Maybe the departure of ideals from our lives is all to the good. Surely ideals are dangerous. Those who commit their lives to ideals sometimes find untimely ends. They can die violent deaths. When they do survive, they often do so in poverty and neglect. And perhaps what the past calls ideals are substantially based upon illusions. Perhaps there are no authentic ideals, only idealizations. Maybe the quest for perfection in thought, in art, in war, and in the exercise of loving kindness only leads to trouble. It's possible that ideals are what Freud, all the time, and Friedrich Nietzsche, most of the time, said they are, sources of delusion. But then again, maybe they're not. Commitment to ideals may be passive from the world, but this should not happen without chance for second thought. Young people who have been traditionally the ones most receptive to ideals should be able to make the choice themselves. Do they want to live a practical life in a practical culture? Do they want to seek safety and security and never risk being made fools of? Or do they want something else? Every generation should be able to hold its own plebiscite on the issue of ideals. But many in the West, coming of age now, have never had the chance to hear the debate. And many of their elders have forgotten or suppressed the issue. Young people have been born into a world where the most pinched version of middle-class values, success, prosperity, safety, health, seem to stand supreme. Some have never encountered alternatives, except in misplaced or disguised forms. Every man and every woman should have the chance to ponder the question of the ideal. Thank you.
Thank you. And before we go on to Mike, I'll ask a quick follow-up, and we'll come back to these questions more. So why do you think ideals are so important in a materialistic culture? Or, to put another way, what is left that is sacred in an age of the selfie?
Well, progressively less and less. The ideals that I talk about, compassion, by way of the Gospels, but also by way of the Buddha and Confucius, courage by way of Homer, with the exemplars being Achilles and Hector, and thought by way of Plato and Emerson, have been subject to considerable debunking within the academy, right? There's a lot of skepticism against claims for total and transcendent truth. There's a lot of skepticism about the human capacity to be compassionate and treat all others as brothers and sisters. And there is, throughout the academy, a general dismissal of anything having to do with warrior heroism, with courage. That's simply banished. That's not acceptable. This debunking, which is a major part of the academic enterprise, is often looked upon as being progressive. That is, it is freeing us from old burdens, old-fashioned ways of living. I don't think so. I think that the debunking or pseudo-debunking of ideals by way of figures like Freud and Nietzsche and many, many others is actually dovetails with the worst dimensions of middle-class life. Live for yourself. Be careful. Prosper. Have a family. Guard your treasure. Don't take a risk. All of those things are becoming stronger and stronger in our culture. I can see why this is true, and I can see that there are more and less decent and humane ways to live the life of the self. But if you tell your children that self is all there is, and middle-class safety and middle-class satisfactions are the beginning and the end of what one can hope for in life, I think that they are going to get very, very depressed. Even if they don't choose an ideal life, a commitment, say, to compassion, they still need to know that there is something out there besides success in the material sense on the one hand and abject failure on the other hand. There is a whole other sphere of meaning to be achieved and to be participated in this world, and most of our students don't know about it because they've never heard about it, or they've never heard about it in a way that is at all persuasive or at all affirmative. So this is what I'm trying to do in this book.
Thank you. We'll go right into Mike, your passage, and just sure. Continue on.
Sure. Thanks. Hi. My book is titled Reading Life, and in a nutshell, basically, it's a book that details the relationship between books and stories and place, how books lead us into the world. I'm in great sympathy with everything that Mark just said, but it might seem as if the passage that I'm going to read is the kind of debunking that he's talking about. But really what we're moving from is an expression of ideas to a recounting of story. So there are X number of chapters in this book, and each chapter deals with a given book that in my life, it's sort of a memoir in books, a given book that that moved me in some way to seek the place that the writer had had written about. So the little section I'm going to read is focuses on Cervantes and Don Quixote, but I'm not going to really mention Cervantes and Don Quixote. Really what I'm going to talk about is a pilgrimage that I took with 10 students on the Santiago de Compostela Camino. And I'm going to read you the section at the end. It just so happened that the pilgrimage that I took with these students, it was a study abroad, turned into a Quixote-like situation, it seemed, and you'll see what happens at the end. And just one thing I'll say is that the word Compostela, as in Santiago de Compostela, Compostela refers to the certificate that you get proving that you are a pilgrim, and you get that if you've walked or ridden a donkey or a bike a certain number of miles. So reaching the cathedral was anticlimactic. We came to the city outskirts and crossed highways and street corners for half an hour before we finally entered the plaza. By the time the students slumped onto the steps, they offered no hugs or cheers or high fives, just one perfunctory photo. And we trudged into the cathedral for Mass, which was scheduled to start in an hour. In the Plaza del Obradorio, a tent city sprawled, mostly filled with young Spaniards who were protesting the 45% unemployment in the country for people between the ages of 16 and 35. The cathedral was already filling up with pilgrims, but we found two empty pews in the back of the church. Three of our students left their backpacks on the seat and queued up with the dozens waiting to kiss the statue of St. James near the altar. A few minutes after they left, a Dutch couple sat in the pew and moved our students' bags to the floors. By the way, I hope nobody is from the Netherlands here, but forgive me in advance. Joellen followed years of Catholic, Joellen is my wife, followed years of Catholic schoolgirl instincts and lied. They just went to confession, she said, offering a dazzling smile. But even the lie and the smile either would have forced any pilgrim not from the Netherlands to pause, just caused the couple to set their faces more grimly toward the heavens. There is no saving, they said in unison, as if it were a response taken from the litany, the word saving bouncing off the walls with multiple connotations. Jeff, one of our students who sat next to me, swung into the pew to save the remaining spaces, angling his considerably broad shoulders in the direction of the sour, much skinnier Dutchman. When the collection tray was passed along the aisle, the man dropped a coin that pinged with its weightlessness. He gave etymological force to the phrase Dutch treat, and if the word skinflint had not been invented for him, he missed the honor by a slim margin. After the collection plate passed, Jeff continued expanding his chest against the other man's retreating ribs. Then the scrawny Dutchman breathed in deeply. Listening to them was like eavesdropping on a yoga class for juvenile delinquents. Inhale, exhale, lion's breath. Who can do the better downward dog? I thought for a moment about leaping over the pew myself and fighting the false pilgrim there and then. It could have been purgative, and besides, it would have made a terrific, ironic conclusion to the narrative of the whole trip. I heard myself echoing Laertes' angry, "I'll cut his throat in the cathedral." But it dawned on me that this wasn't Hamlet, and just about everyone came to a bad end in that play, in that story anyway, and who would truly be the juvenile delinquent or the false pilgrim if I initiated a brawl a few minutes before Mass started? No matter how far I had fallen from my Catholic beginnings, I hadn't fallen quite that far. So I opted instead to go to confession, finding the only priest who could hear my confession in English. He was, no lie, from the Netherlands. Bless me, Father, if I have sinned. It's been about 35 years since my last confession. I've sort of lost contact with the church. Of course, that surely was a lie in itself. It was probably more like 40 years. I didn't confess that sin, though, or any others, not even my momentary intention of attacking one of his countrymen in the cathedral. We just chatted about the Camino, and he wished for me good luck and the chance to renew my faith. I told him I hoped for the same thing. Kneeling there before the Dutch priest, I wondered if it were possible or desirable to regain the sort of innocent faith I had in childhood, where prayers had the chance of being answered, a landscape in which loved ones protected me and the future was limitless? Or would such innocence, if it could be recaptured, only be another form of tragedy or comedy? But a roar from the crowd cut short the question. The Pilgrim's Mass in Santiago is the only time I've ever heard applause at the end of a Catholic service. The churchgoers cheered for the Bota Fumero show, a silver incense burner that is reputed to be the largest of its kind in the world. It took eight men, a team called Atirboleros, to tie the knots and get the incense belcher swinging at a rate that could decapitate dozens from as many countries if it shifted direction. Supposedly, the original reason for the Bota Fumero was the horrible stench of the pilgrims. The Bota Fumero was first used as a massive deodorizer. I had taken my sweaty, dust-covered shoes off and placed them under the kneeler, and assuming I was not alone in this selfish, sacrilegious act, the Bota Fumero still served its original purpose well. Before I left the church, I offered the sign of peace to the Dutchman and his wife. My soul surely was not pure, but I did shake his hands. I did shake their hands. My half-hearted confession didn't totally go to waste. The next 2 days in Santiago, students shopped, and went to spas. No one, to my knowledge, saw a burning bush, me included. We all received our Compostelas, though, and it didn't seem unfitting that two of our female students came close to a fistfight as we waited in line for the Pilgrim certificates. I just realized, one said, raising her brown eyes to the cloudy sky, that there were people who complained more than me on this trip. That's not true, said the young woman next to her. No, I didn't complain as much as some, the first girl continued. I don't know about that, was the answer. Shut the fuck up, the most fragile looking of our co-eds chimed in. If you say one more word, I'm going to rave on someone. Then the clerk called them forward to get their certificates, proving that they had been on a spiritual pilgrimage.
I must say, I think it's probably Netflix, I saw The Way about right. the Santiago pilgrimage. Many of you may have seen it. Emilio Estevez directed it with his father, Martin Sheen. Right. And now I know that it was a documentary. I thought it was just made up. Right. So thanks for that.
Imagine if they had students.
Right. You should see the movie. My question is, we talk about, in poetry, there's a famous phrase, make it new. Uh-huh. And I think one thing I wonder about is somebody, you do somewhere between literary criticism and personal memoir, right. which I think is in many ways the definition of a particular type of travel writing. Mm-hmm. And so how do you decide what experience you're going to write about, what writer you want to explore in that way versus just literary analysis?
Yeah. I have a couple of books that sort of deal with this sort of strange kind of literary adventure or, you know, travel literary adventure in some sort or another. The first book I wrote 25 years ago really is Imagine Places, Journeys into Literary America is the title of it. And it's really like a bookend to this one. It's the same book, except, it's just like the same book. Let's use Henry James's, you know, House of Fiction. It's the same house, but I'm going in a different door, I think. So in that book, in which I talked about writers who I was was and am passionate about, a Mark Twain, a William Faulkner, a Flannery O'Connor, or John Steinbeck, et cetera, Hemingway. I was trying to understand those writers better. So I looked at those writers because I care deeply about them, and I went to the places that they gave life to in one form or another in their work to try to understand their writing better. This was sort of the reverse. I looked at books that I care about, but not necessarily. I mean, Cervantes. I've got a PhD in American literature, so what I know about Spanish literature is I've come upon on my own. But really, there I was looking at books over the course of my life that had led me someplace, that sort of pushed me out into the world. And I was sort of thinking about this, and we may get to rock and roll later on, but I was thinking about this in terms of, we all experience this in terms of music, in terms of films, and I think in terms of books. And maybe this is happening to fewer and fewer people in terms of books, but the way I grew up, books meant everything to me. And in a way, I don't want to over-dramatize it or over-romanticize it, but in a way, I feel that they saved my life. So I grew up in the Bronx. Morris was referring to, when he talked about memoirs, he was referring to a book I had written, Dreaming of Columbus, A Boyhood in the Bronx. And so I felt that for me, books allowed, you know, sort of saved my life in terms of allowing me to imagine something beyond where I was. So I think I'm answering your question. That is, with my first book, it was writers that I wanted to understand better. In this book, the writers I chose, I care about them, but it was really the places I was looking at. So I was looking at the writers to help me figure out those places and go to those places.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
And thank you. And and Matt, thanks for your patience. And if you will read from yours, and I'll say that I had the pleasure of blurbing this as a manuscript, which seemed infinitely preemptive of his agent, but I thought that was smart. And so for a lot of reasons that will become clear, this is a special book, and I'm glad that you're reading.
Thanks. Well, I needed your blurb to get the agent, so thank you very much. My book's called Dead White Guys, and basically the book is an exploration of the great books of the Western world, which was a set curated by Robert Maynard Hutchins and Mortimer Adler in the 50s. And I wrote it for my daughter. It's a series of letters. This represents the first year of a suggested reading list. The Great Books of the Western World is a 54-volume set. It contains 440 works that are really widely considered as I think you would say, it's the traditional Western canon that now is sort of looked down upon in the academy. I think that would be fair. So it's written as a series of letters to my daughter, and I'm just going to read from the preface a little bit. You were fortunate to be born as a citizen of one of history's greatest empires, one that had mastered the material world. But in our rise to global dominance, our empire, as all empires before it, forgot about the immaterial world, even ridiculed it as silly or lacking utility or value. And we have now come to suffer the consequences of that neglect. Those consequences were on vivid display in 2010, the year you arrived in this world. Financial ruin, disastrous wars, a broken and corrupt political system, they're all connected, and they are not unique to the modern era. Perhaps things will have changed by the time you read this, but today in America, value has increasingly come to mean monetary value. In 2010, Georgetown University's Center on Education set out to determine the value of various college degrees by measuring lifetime earnings of graduates. Not surprisingly, median annual earnings for English and humanities majors were much lower than median earnings for engineering and science majors. I don't want to slight Shakespeare, said one of the authors of the study, but this study slights Shakespeare. This is how you will be taught to measure value, Violet. Because America has always been an economic and technological culture, we demand empirical metrics from everything. As capitalists, we insist that everything intrinsically possesses some sort of return on investment. If I spend X dollars studying Shakespeare, then I should reap X dollars plus one from the enterprise, or else it has somehow been deficient. I have some experience with Mr. Shakespeare. He paid my salary when I got out of college. In my first job out of college, I worked for Chicago Shakespeare Theater. I managed databases for them, and I orchestrated direct mail campaigns. Although widely used in other industries, these were relatively new tools for the theater world, and they demanded some minor administrative changes in the way that the theater conducted its affairs. But when we produced Hamlet, nobody changed the script. Why didn't we? A primitive man like Shakespeare couldn't speak to our technological age with our higher standard of living, our computers and our internet, our brain scans, our airplanes, and our thermonuclear devices. We could do better than Shakespeare. Maybe I could improve upon Shakespeare, possessing an education that was far superior to Shakespeare's own. Shakespeare didn't know what I did. He didn't know about atoms, evolution, or gravity. He certainly didn't know how disease was transmitted. The man seldom bathed himself, and he likely tossed his excrement out the window into the street. He didn't know how to build a database or why one would ever need such a thing. He'd never traveled around the world. He barely understood that there were other continents on the other side of the ocean. He clearly had problems with the geography and history of his own country. His writing is filled with monsters, fairies, and ghosts. What a silly, dirty, ignorant man he was. And what's the point of another production of Hamlet? The play had been produced millions of times. Surely everyone had seen it already. The audience knew everything that was going to happen. Wouldn't they be bored? There was nothing new in Hamlet. Hamlet wasn't even new when Shakespeare wrote it. He ripped off the plot and characters from another guy's play, and that guy probably stole the plot from somebody else. The basic plot structure goes all the way back to ancient Greece, to Aeschylus, who invented the plot structure in the Oresteia. Guy's dad is killed. Guy agonizes over what to do. Guy avenges his dad's murder. Guy goes bonkers. And hadn't we, as a technologically advanced civilization, answered Prince Hamlet's questions by now? Can we ask the questions of Hamlet in our search engines the way we get a stock quote or find directions? How are we to behave in an immoral world? How do we know the truth? What is reality? What is justice? What happens to us when we die? Do we have control over our own lives, or are we destined to do the things we do? Why do bad things happen? Does God exist? If God exists, does he care what happens to me? What do I owe the state? What do I owe my family? What do I owe myself? When should I use force? When should I break the law? Why do I want what I cannot have? Why do the wicked seem to prosper while the good seem to suffer? Why do I feel so alone? What is courage? Why am I here? Why is anyone here? Am I just a machine, or do I have a soul? I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. Today, you're all grown up, and I hope this letter finds you on an adventure of your choice, someplace far away from your mom and me. But once a long time ago, back in fall of 2012, we walked together to the park in Alexandria, Virginia. I always loved walking with you when you were little. You'd hold my hand for a little bit, and when you got tired, you'd ride on my shoulders. You were just beginning to speak in full sentences then, and that day you suddenly became aware that there were other daddies and other children at the park. You knew we were like them somehow. We weren't exactly them, but we were all similar in some ways. We took a break and we sat in a park bench, you with a juice box in your hand. You saw another father putting his daughter in the swing and you pointed to him and said, "He's a daddy, and you're a daddy." I was impressed by your realization, by your ability to categorize things in the world. I marveled at how purely Aristotelian your thinking was. You were creating that space in your brain that identified the shared characteristics of daddies. Daddies took you to the park. Daddies put you on their shoulders. Daddies helped you get in the swing. I said, "That's right, Violet. He's a daddy, and I'm a daddy. But what are you?" You thought about this for a minute, your little eyes searching for an answer, processing, processing. Then you smiled and you pointed to yourself. "I'm a Violet," you said. "You're more than a machine, Violet. There are things in life that can't fit inside little boxes. There is a value that can't be measured in dollars. There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy."
There's a natural linking throughout these books about the Western canon and contemporary writers, and that's probably what we'll spend the bulk of the rest of the time on. But Matt, one thing that I really appreciate about your book is it's both it's a love letter to your daughter, clearly, but it's a how-to manual too about the life well lived. And one thing that I really appreciated there is at various points in the book, you stop and talk about the importance of a mentor in your life. You certainly talk about that in Chicago. Somebody inspires you. Also, somebody tells you when you're just wrong. And I wanted to just ask you if you might comment a little bit on when we talk about having ideals or passing forward thinking, what you think about the role of mentors in that.
Well, I think mentors are extremely important in my life. I've been blessed by a number of great mentors. I guess the specific point that you're talking about in Chicago, I think the most important lesson that gentleman taught me was I was one of the things the book does is I reflect on my own problems. Basically, I'm this is why I'm a terrible person, and these why how the books help me be a better person. And in this instance, it was about my mentor in Chicago, who was a genius. He was a producer at Chicago Shakespeare Theater. And I had a lot of preconceptions about homosexuals, actually. And he was gay, and he taught me that I was wrong about everything that I thought, both about business and about the way that I perceived homosexual culture. So I think mentors are critical.
Absolutely, and I think a book is playing that role. And Mark, something you wrote in VQR, The Paint Factory, sometimes about moving from a blue-collar job into your academic life, in some ways both a place can be a mentor, and sometimes a mentor is just telling you exactly what life not to live, which is a point of connection. I just wonder if you wanted to reflect on that, whether that's as a mentor or as a teacher yourself.
That's a really nice question. I wish I'd had a couple of weeks to prepare for it. the objective, it seems to me, and you're quite right, the Packard Paint Factory was a mentor to me. There's that moment in Melville's Moby Dick where he says, "A whaling ship was my Harvard and my Yale." For a while, Packard Paint was my Harvard and my Yale. There's a lot to learn there. And some people took me under their wings and helped me make it through. It was only a summer, being honest. But I learned a lot there. One of the critical things, it seems to me, that one can aim at as a university teacher is making the transition oneself from teacher into mentor, right? Because I think the teacher is somebody who imparts information, introduces texts, offers skills, develops writing. But the mentor is somebody who is able to help the student ask the question, what does this have to do with the conduct of my life? What does this have to do with the conduct of collective life? So that it's not enough to learn how to read Shakespeare, analyze Shakespeare. You really got to ask that question, what am I going to do with it? Am I going to try to write inspired by Shakespeare? Am I going to try to live my life that, from my point of view, exemplifies the sort of skepticism that runs all through Shakespeare and is manifest in his two great fellows, mentioned, one of them mentioned here, his exact contemporary Cervantes and his predecessor Montaigne. So asking those questions and bringing literature to the life of the individual, right, is the thing that separates teacher from mentor. There's a tension here, though, and the tension is that most of my students have been, as it were, programmed for success from the time they were in high school. So what they most want is good grades, skills, and facility. They believe they know what it is they need and where it is they are going. And it can be a little bit annoying when the question arises, is that really what you need? Is that really where you're going? It's never been as fraught and never been as tense to ask that question, at least in my experience at the University of Virginia. But it's probably never been as rewarding either, because when you break through and start having the conversation about what kinds of lives really are available that go beyond what you were programmed to expect in high school, sometimes too programmed to expect by your parents, those are very rich exchanges indeed, but they are hard to come by.
I just want to add my two cents to this, in terms of mentors. And the mentor that I would mention for me and that I've talked a lot about in reading life is my mother, who gave me a lot of books and sort of opened that world to me. But I'm thinking of something that she said to me when I was a sophomore in college. You know what you like when you're a sophomore in college. Your parents, God, how could they be so stupid when you're so smart, that kind of thing. And she said, literature is there, books are there, they should make people better. And I thought, well, that's really a very foolish sort of statement. You know, that's not what it's all about. I was all postmodern at that point. But as I've gotten older, I think, there's something absolutely correct, about that. And I'm thinking about that statement, which seemed truer to me as I got older. And I'm thinking about your question about, in this age of selfie. And you sort of sent that question to us via email, and I thought about it a little bit before I came in today. And it seems to me that perhaps books or literature is actually the ultimate selfie and the ultimate unselfie at the same time. It's the ultimate selfie in the sense that it's it forces you to really look at yourself, look at your own picture, but it also forces you to look outside of yourself. So I'm thinking like Northrop Frye, the notion of literature gives us both the dream and the nightmare. And I think it gives us both what is the deepest inside of us and forces us to sort of reach outside of us and try to understand someone else's experience.
Just to put a cherry on top of that very quickly, I think of Mark Twain's line that goes something like this. I won't get it exactly right. It's just amazing how much smarter my father got between the time I was 25 and 30. Couldn't say much for him before that.
Oh, I was just going to add on that it is amazing how, in the Western canon anyway, I mean, the one thing that I learned in this enterprise is how important it is to be skeptical, how important it is to tear down your own preconceived notions of who you are and what you think you want, because society pumps you full of these ideas, just as you were saying, that they, all you want to do is make money, be productive, but that's not really the end goal of life, and that there's a difference between being a participant in a capitalist society and being a human being on the other side.
Absolutely. And I don't know whether it's your publisher who made the decision to name your book Dead Right Guys, but I appreciate the candor of it, if you're going to talk about the canon. And when I know about the careers of each of you, I know your commitment to aesthetic diversity in the academy and in the public culture, ethnic diversity, racial diversity. But we're still talking a lot about Plato and Homer. And when we talk about that canon, and the canon can't be complete without Rita Dove's museum or Richard Wright's writing in the 20s or Amy Tan, and how it's a challenge on the one hand that we're trying to get any books held onto, just literary culture, period. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's a natural reality that we have to jettison some books to make room for others. So just any reflections you might have on the fact that there is a natural whittling down. So that means that you're unlikely to have students that know Marcus Aurelius, that when I came through school at a small school in Mississippi, you know, the Aeneid opens with Arma Vermque Cano, of arms and the man I sing, and that was just established, and we were not a good school. I don't know that we prepare students in that same way. And just kind of reflections about losing part of the canon while we have essential works that we have to add to it.
I could speak first, I guess, on that, because in the great books of the Western world, it was produced in 1950, and the editors of the set didn't, they stopped at 1900 because they felt that they weren't qualified to speak about what was going to happen in the 20th century. The 20th century was an incredible century by historical standards. You had the world population exploding. You had democratization in all sorts of ways. So there's certainly, and I saw the democratization of literature firsthand at AWPI, but I think one of the dangers in that, or one of the risks, is that we've become obsessed with modernity. And it's interesting that you use that quote, make it new. I think that's Pound, right?
Right.
And but Pound and the modernists who were instrumental in making that turn, they were all schooled in the classics. They began their education there. And I think that's where you kind of got to start. And I know that there's, I know that, it has to be incorporated, but if we're just speaking to each other as if all human thought began in the last 150 years, we got a problem.
Right, and I'll just say that I direct the creative writing program at Old Dominion University, and so our MFA students, we place a great emphasis on their literature, the literature courses that they take, because you have to be a reader to be a writer. I think Flannery O'Connor was absolutely correct, at least for me. I mean, I think there are two sort of cliches about how writers are formed. One is trauma, you know, so, you know, if you're lucky, your father beat you, and then you become a writer. The other is, you know, that writers are created by stories and by books. And I think O'Connor said most writers are not created by life, but by literature. And I think that's the cliche that I fall into, and that's, I think, accurate in terms of, you know, in terms of my own life. But we place a great emphasis on the literature because you have to understand the tradition that you're working in, you know, in order to be a writer.
Yeah,
I'll give it a shot. Yeah,
yeah.
Make it new. I love the line. I love Pound. Though I could have done without some of those radio broadcasts. Yeah. But my watchword, at least for the writing of this book, I've written a lot of other books about other subjects, is not so much make it new, but keep it old. and the reason for that is that I am interested in the most powerful, persuasive, and intricate statements I can find about these fundamental ideals, courage, contemplation, and compassion. Now, one of the things that you should know about these ideals is that they are, as far as I can tell, universal. There is probably no culture that does not admire the heroic warrior. There is surely no culture that does not have wise men and wise women. There is no culture that does not respect and admire the compassionate, humane, loving individual. It is absolutely as close to universal as anybody can find. Were I an African scholar of literature, I probably would have found African antecedents for these particular virtues. If I were an Asian scholar, I could readily have found Asian antecedents. I am an American, Europeanly trained scholar, and so I take the best that my tradition has, which I know something about. But one of the things I note in the book is that these are as close to being universal values, from my point of view, I've studied it for some time, as any that one can find. The value that is questionable in this regard is the value of the artistic creator, which may, it's first of all, it's a baby, it's only a couple hundred years old, and it may have a certain status in the West that it does not enjoy in other cultures. But at the center of this book is something that I take to be, and this is verboten in the academy, universal or close to universal.
And, you know, I'll just reflect on the fact that I yesterday I went into a general English class at Old Dominion, which is for all English majors. And I here's the thing I dread about going into that class, that I know the one question they're going to ask me that I'm not going to have a good answer for, and that is, what do I do with this? You know, what do I do with this degree? But, you know, I hear what Mark is saying, and but I sympathize with those students, too. You know, and you know, my advice to them, you know, after I tried to give them some practical things that you can do with an English major, my advice to them, I said, I give you the same advice I give my own sons, and that is, find something you love and pursue that. And I think, you know, that's what Mark is talking about. But, you know, I think he's also right that we live in a culture in which, you know, the focus is on, it's gone so far over to the practical that to give such advice is find what you love and pursue it, it'll be okay. Practically seems ludicrous. I saw it in their faces. You know, they looked at me like some sort of sappy uncle that was a little bit that had been hit in the head, you know, at some place along the way. And the only other thing I want to say right here is that we're talking about dead white males, but we are live white males up here. I just realized that. That's something strange about that.
So let's open it up to the audience, and I may bring in a few questions here and there. So, yes.
Senior scholars. And number two, why is something that's universal, why did you say that that was verboten in Canada?
The first answer, yes, of course. Love to see you there. I do. I will say, though, since I'm sometimes an annoying person, many times people my age come to class, and they're admirable, lovely, wonderful people, but they think because we're the same age, we're both going to teach the class. That ain't going to happen. I know you wouldn't do that to me. Why are these universals out of fashion? It's really hard to say why we go where we go in the academy. Sometimes I think it's because we've simply said all we have that can be said on one side of the question, so we shift to the other side almost arbitrarily so we can write more books, teach more classes, have more seminars, and, you know, cause more disruption. I honestly do not know. I honestly do not know. I think that, you know, for some time, anthropologists, psychologists, philosophers told us that we were a family of human beings, and now suddenly they are telling us that we are all diverse one to another, right? I respect the differences among human beings, but I do believe that there are some central kinds of values that you can actually put forward to students, right? Do you want to be compassionate? Do you want to be brave? Do you want to be a thinker? And when they make a face at me like this is sappy, I say, these are the most difficult, arduous, and painful kinds of lives available, and they become much more happy. Because at least it's realistic, right? I mean, these are lives that, if you just follow the biography of the people who live them, you know, Confucius seems to come out the best, and he never has any money, and he's always wandering around different places, but he's got a bunch of friends. You know, the Buddha tramps around for 40 years in India preaching, and by the time he eventually eats that tainted pork, you can see he's really glad to go. We know what happened to Jesus, to Socrates, to Achilles, to Hector. You know, enough said, right?
What I appreciate about your book is you make the point that there were a hero culture, citizen soldiers such as Hector, Achilles on the fearless warrior side of your terms. And then we think, and that went away, and you make a point that I had not seen it, all the connection, that we have simulated heroes. And you say in your book, video games make heroes of us all. And so do you think in many ways we're just laying in all these substitutions?
Yes. I call it, you can see this is a completely unfriendly book. I end by calling our culture the culture of the counterfeit, okay? And the culture of the counterfeit involves the fabrication of the ideals. We can't live without these things, right? because they're so great and looming, but we can't live with them because they're so dangerous and make us feel so unhappy that we've chosen the lives that we have. So we choose to fabricate them. You fabricate, as you say, you fabricate kind of the heroic life online and in the movies and in books and wherever all else. You fabricate the thinker's life by replacing Platonic quest for eternal or universal knowledge with the quest for information. You stay up to date. You stay informed. You got to check the news. You got to check your Facebook thing. You got to look at that little device. What's it called? It's called a phone, an iPhone. And so you don't seek eternal wisdom anymore because you've been persuaded by the bombardment of news that there is no such thing as eternal wisdom, and there are only new things that displace each other one after another. So you have to stay up. You have to stay current. We have, you see, I really get on a sled here. We have, instead of a culture of artistic creation, and drawing on Northrop Frye, I do some talking about what I think authentic artistic creation is, and we've replaced that with the democratization of artistic creation. All you have to do is start a garage band, and you're an artist. Wrap a little while into a tin can, you're an artist. You know, make something on the wall that's kind of a mess. Everybody is an artist, right? But nobody is, if everybody is, because there are, we have expected artists to do things for us, show us the dark side, and also show us the possibilities, as you say. The ideology, the ideal of compassion is so dangerous that I don't think anybody even tries to fabricate it, right? We create authoritarian religions. We create religions of self in the economic success. But compassion is very alluring, available to everybody, and really very both alluring and dangerous, so we just don't talk about it all that much. And there are, to be sure, there are many more compassionate individuals out there than there are probably people devoted to being great warriors or devoted to being to finding eternal truth. There truly are compassionate people who might have the greatest admiration for it. There just aren't enough of them.
Yeah, I feel like I'm the amateur between two scholars, and by that I mean I have a PhD, but I'm amateur in the root, meaning of that word, lover of books, and sort of I've read books. I met Eudora Welty some many years back in reading at Mississippi, and she said, I was asking about the books she read, and she said she just read them randomly and indiscriminately, and and I think that's the way I've read them as well. But I think what Mark is saying makes absolute sense. And when he said he couldn't really answer the question, why is this the case? Why is these questions being pushed to the side? It's arrogant of me to say I have the answer. But teacher, I think I've got an answer for myself on that, and I think it's because what Mark is implying, it requires a really complex vocabulary to talk about these questions. And I think we live in this, we've dumbed down. I'm going to open up Pandora's box right now and invoke the name Donald Trump. But we have dumbed down the language, I think, and we also are in this sort of post-ironic age where, to talk about things like compassion, honor, dignity, loyalty, et cetera, they seem, as Mark was saying, that's sappy or that's corny or, it's not cool somehow to talk about this. But I'm just thinking, because my wife and I were talking about this, Donald Trump's vocabulary, and, I apologize if you're from the Netherlands and voting for Donald Trump, then I'll soon get to the trifecta here, but, if you take the word wonderful, great, and a few others, out of the dictionary of him, the guy is mute. He only has about five words. And so I think when you get a situation where there seems to be a crowd that will listen and sort of communicate on that level, they're certainly not going to be discussing the things that Professor Edmondson is talking about.
Well, just to piggyback on that, we've become a nation that elevates information above wisdom.
Sure.
And there's a difference between the two. And the pursuit of wisdom is actually something that we should inculcate in our children. That's what I think anyway. And I saw there was a recent study that analyzed Trump's vocabulary as the vocabulary of an 11-year-old, which is not surprising to me because he's dumbed it down to that sixth grade level.
Not a smart 11-year-old.
No, right, exactly. But wisdom, justice, temperance, courage. It's interesting, in a presidential, we're in a presidential season right now. These four words don't come up almost at all. The only one who used any of them, I think, is Bernie Sanders when he talks about justice. Yep. And these are qualities we should seek in a president, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah, Matt, your book, I isolated a quote in here which I thought might be relevant. And I'll just read, and you should be clear, he published it long before the presidential cycle. He said, "Even though the politician knows how to pass legislation, wage war, and navigate various factions, he doesn't possess any actual wisdom." And what I appreciate you did thereafter is tied it for your daughter to Socrates, because it's not enough just to trade barbs, but to actually say, okay, then what embodies it? And so I don't, that's a statement more than a question.
Sure, but for Socrates, which is the biggest takeaway I took away from the book, actually, because Apology is the first book on the list. Huh. And I'd never read Apology before, and I highly recommend it. It's very short. It's easy to read. He's the true manifestation of wisdom for Socrates was to know that your wisdom was in truth worth nothing, that only the gods are wise and people don't know anything about anything. And so he was considered the wisest of men because he knew that he didn't know anything, which I think is the it's a perfect definition of wisdom.
Yeah. Yes.
Poetry? Not specifically. It comes up, I suppose, in terms of Shakespeare, I think, in terms of the oral tradition, because it wasn't so long ago that human beings could recite thousands of pages of poetry from memory, verbatim, and the way they could do that was because of the invention of poetic devices. So poetry itself, no, it didn't. And actually, poetry is actually one of those... It's pretty absent from the great books of the Western world, unless you consider Shakespeare and unless you consider, Homer.
Hmm. And what about in your English classes? Is poetry front and center, or in the middle, or at the end of what you teach?
It is. It's front and center for me. I think of poetry as the heart of literature, and virtually every year I will teach at least two of my courses. I teach modern poetry, which is, Stevens, Frost, Auden, Moore, Bishop. And I teach romantic poetry, Blake, Wordsworth, Shelley, Coleridge. And then the Americans also, Whitman, Emerson, not a poet, but wishing he were, Emily Dickinson. So that's the heart of my personal curriculum. But I talk about that in somewhat different terms than I do about these ideals. It's a long story, and it takes a term to unfold. But poetry will break our hearts together is falling out of the English department curriculum.
And even though I teach creative writing classes, and I don't teach poetry. I mean, I teach mainly nonfiction, but I teach a study abroad class in Ireland each summer, and I'm going to do it again this summer. And one of the requirements that I have for the students in that class, because we look at all the genres, poetry and fiction, nonfiction, playwriting, everybody has to recite a Yeats poem in the shadow of Ben Bulbin. So last year that was pretty traumatic for some students. That was, just the idea of memorizing something. So we really don't do that, much anymore.
Yeah. Reading habits have been created by the internet, right? So you read fast, you skim, you grab the sense. The idea of being compelled to read something 3 or 4 or 11 times in order to begin a dialogue with it, I won't say it's unavailable to my students, but it's fairly remote at the beginning of the term and just comes a little closer every week.
I definitely say that the loss of poetry at the center of the humanities is at a canary in the coal mine in some ways. You mentioned Frost, my... former boss, Dana Gioia, fine poet and NEA chairman, he quoted Frost often, and since he's not in the room, I'll claim it as if it was my idea, not his. But Frost said, "Poetry is a way of remembering what it would impoverish us to forget." And that's, I think, somewhat we fear is this general impoverishment of the mind and the loss of the memorizing of great works is one component of that. More questions? We'll probably go for a little less than 10 minutes. We need to leave room for signings. Yes?
Not a political question, but I have a good friend, Dalton Blake, Southern Baptist preacher. If, Mr. Edmondson, if these ideas, particularly compassion, are supposed to be universal, how would you answer him? He's not a Trump person, thank God. But he would say that the Muslims are out to destroy us, a terrible civilization. Obviously, I don't believe.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'd ask him first, has he ever been to an Islamic country? Has he ever spent time in Morocco or Egypt? Has he ever had a Muslim friend in one of those countries? I mean, Muslim hospitality is known throughout the world and not without reason, right? But it's also, I haven't been in a Muslim country for a while, it's also possible that certain nations, certain religions, at least in some part of them, can harden over and become more interested in politics than they are in the compassionate vision of their founders. This just happens all of the time. I'm not saying that's happening in Islam. I simply don't know. I do think that in terms of war and peace, strictly patriarchal religions can be a little bit more volatile than the others. Now, that includes our own, right? But I would get a little firsthand experience on that one, I think, if that's not unfair. Though he might ask you to pay his fare.
You know, one of the things I'll say is that I was asking Mark before. We both taught on Semester at Sea, which used to be under the aegis of University of Virginia. But one of the things that I felt, the experience with Semester at Sea, is it sort of gave me and gave the students exactly what Mark is talking about. Go to Egypt and meet somebody who's Muslim, and you'll see how, you know, as you know, Matt was saying before, you know, in the playground there, how much we are alike, you know, and that's what this person can't see, maybe because he hasn't stepped beyond the boundaries.
And I'll plug your book and say that you talk about going to Morocco and Egypt both in this current book. I get a commission though on that. So, elsewhere. Yes.
It is curious. I think I will return to the political disturb in a broader context. That when I was at UVA, I had a course in British public address in the 18th century and learned that there were three aspects to a presentation: ethos, logos, and pathos. And it sounds as if some individuals have maybe adapted things from our culture, films, video games, as Mr. Edmondson suggests, that maybe have lost the logos, because the pathos in persuading someone will be sufficient that if there are a word cloud, if there's a word cloud of Mr. Trump's speeches, for example, and he has only a certain number of words which are indicative of some of the virtues that the courage and compassion and so forth that seem to invigorate someone as if they were directly experiencing. It seems like that's what he's doing, almost like a spectacle in a Sam Shepard drama or something. And that it seems as if the logos, Hillary and Bernie do logos. Bernie sometimes is, you know, repetitive about a certain theme, but he doesn't get rid of the logos. Yeah. This is what I find to be very remarkable in almost as a critical element of our current contemporary.
Yeah, I couldn't say it any better than that. But I'll just a paraphrase of a line from T.S. Eliot is, teach us to sit still. Mm-hmm. Well, what does Eliot mean by that? Teach us to be quiet, be by ourselves, contemplate, pray in his case, read, write, think, converse with friends. And the virtue of learning how to sit still and fight off boredom, which does come, is that you don't then acquire an addiction to stimulation, right? I mean, one of the things that a computer is, and I wrestle with this all the time myself, is a stimulation machine, okay? And so you want to be stimulated and diverted all the time, right? And so as more and more the need for stimulation rises, you seek better stimulation, more interesting stimulation, and in the case of a certain presidential candidate, more potentially dangerous stimulation. The show must go on. So the capacity to sit by oneself and read a book or talk to a friend is the capacity that allows you to be righteously dismissive of someone who brings you entertainment as politics or politics as entertainment. And that begins, I think, something John's been very interested in the quiet arts of reading and in the quiet arts of meditation and contemplation. If I say something like this to my students, they look at me completely shocked. How could we want more, not want more stimulation and more stimulation and more stimulation, even though they tell me that they are besieged badly by a boredom all the time, to which I say it's because you are addicted to stimulation and the last day stimulation won't do, et cetera, et cetera. And they say, oh, it's nice to be old and know everything. And as soon as they get out of class, it's like gunfight at the OK Corral, right? They grab that, because I won't let them have anything electric there, grab that phone and start looking at it. What you going to do?
I'll just say something about Trump. Just let's go full political here, because what's
I think we're getting to closing statements
sure.
for ourselves too.
In Book 9 of the Republic, there's a great description of the rise of the demagogue, and
yes,
you cannot get more textbook than watching Donald Trump follow this formula. It's unbelievable, so I highly recommend it. It won't end well for him or the country if he's elected.
Close.
Let's probably not the close.
Book 9 of the Republic.
Just some closing up
okay.
remarks.
Yeah, I really have no closing statement. I feel like I'm, a candidate for office or something. But I will say this, John, promoted my book as my agent and mentioned that in Reading Life, there are two chapters, one about Muslim countries, one about Morocco, and one about Egypt. But the chapter about Egypt, which is really... an essay called Searching for Youssef. It's about a hunter driver in Alexandria, Egypt, that I met twice in 2002 and in 2006 and again 2009, and the relationship that I developed with him. And, worlds apart, different people, different economic, different intellectual situations, but we became... as he said to me when I was leaving in 2009, we are brothers. And I just think I'd get a copy of the book for your friend, give it to him stick it in his, golf bag. That's.
So what I would say is just kind of thank you, right? I mean, books, I've spent my life being engaged with them, 45 years or so, and I'm afraid it's dying out. And I wonder, before I come to something like this, is anybody else going to be here? But here you are, all of you, and you listened so kindly and so hard and paid such good attention and asked such wonderful questions, and you laughed at my jokes or those utterances that aspire to be jokes. So thank you.
And I'll come back to something that's in Michael's book, but it really, I'll turn it back to Matt on this. Michael quotes Flannery O'Connor, wonderful chapter on Flannery O'Connor, and she says, people without hope do not write novels, which I think is wonderful, and you have to understand that she was well aware that she was heading toward a premature death. And your book to your daughter is an act of hope. I mean, the idea is that she will, it's like Fahrenheit 451, she will be one who carries books forward, and I just wondered if you might talk about that in closing.
Sure. Well, my main goal for Violet was to teach her what these books, I think, taught me, which is I wanted to teach her how to think, not what to think. And that's the difference between, I think, modern academia and how it was maybe 500 years ago. And that's basically it. I mean,
thank you all three. Mark.